Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Black journalists told they can't cover protests, racially insensitive headlines, a revolt in some newsrooms. Both the pandemic and national protests are raising a mirror in which America is taking an honest look at itself. And journalists often consider themselves among the hands that hold up that mirror. So what's being reflected back about their own newsrooms, about long-held presumptions on what constitutes objectivity or who should cover stories in their communities? So this hour on Point, the media's internal reckoning with race. And we will start today in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with Alexis Johnson. She's a journalist at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And Alexis, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, you are here because I understand that you have been told there was a response to a tweet that you put out, a response from the management of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Can you tell us what happened to you?
Sure. The first protests that were in response to the death of George Floyd happened in Pittsburgh. I think it was Saturday, May 30th. On Sunday, I sent a tweet, you know, saying like, you know, look at these horrifying scenes from looters. And it was like, oh, no, wait, this is just a Kenny Chesney concert. You know, it's I just quickly Googled some pictures of Kenny Chesney aftermath because it's, you know, it's being from Pittsburgh. It's almost a running joke, you know, about kind of the destruction that, you know, these concert goers leave behind every year. So, you know, I wasn't much thought put into the tweet. I just kind of sent it and went on about my day. And by that night, it had went viral, I guess, so to speak. It had maybe like 30,000 retweets or so. And Monday morning I came in, you know, because I work Monday through Friday. So I hadn't at that point got the chance to cover anything that was protest related. And I pitched a bunch of ideas to my editors. And by that afternoon, they told me that I was not going to be able to cover anything that was related to this issue because they felt that that specific tweet showed bias. They said that I violated our social media guidelines, which we don't have. This isn't a policy that our union ever signed off on. And they felt that the credibility of the newsroom will be called into question if I were to put my byline on any stories around this issue going forward because of that tweet.
Mm. Okay, so there's a lot to dig into here, Alexis. First of all, just for clarification, can you tell me a little bit more about why you put that tweet out to begin with?
Sure. Like I said, it's almost, you know, it's a known thing for Pittsburghers, you know, what Kenny Chesney fans do to that area of our city. Mm-hmm. He sells out Heinz Field, which is where the Steelers play. So, you know, hundreds of thousands of country music fans come every year to tailgate, you know, from sunup to sundown. Most of them don't even have tickets to the concert, if we're being honest. And they leave behind destruction. I mean, the city has spoken out against it. They've put plans together in place in following years to kind of control that kind of crowd. So it really was just, you know, I'm a millennial. I speak Twitter. It really was just, you know, a tweet that, you know, was just food for thought about, you know, how we look at destruction in our city as far as where it comes from and why people are doing it, you know, kind of in the larger conversation about what was happening with the looting and stuff like that. But I, you know, like I said, it wasn't meant to be this big statement or anything like that. I kind of just went on about my day after
right.
I sent it.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at a May 7th, 2020 editorial from the editorial board of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, whose headline is "Delay the Kenny Chesney Concert. This is no time for tens of thousands to gather." Right. And I mean,
isn't that interesting?
The first couple of graphs here just says the city of Pittsburgh has a complex relationship with Kenny Chesney. Since 2007, the country superstar has regularly performed. But the shows have also featured widespread debauchery, dozens of people typically arrested, literal tons of trash have filled parking lots. The damage, however, would pale in comparison to the devastation that could occur if Mr. Chesney's May 30th concert at Heinz Field goes ahead as planned. That is from the editorial board of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
from May 7th. Thank you for bringing that to my attention.
But I'd also say, in addition to that, it's an editorial. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette management staff had an issue with your tweet because they see your tweet as having been editorial, which they didn't see was appropriate for a reporter.
Sure. And, you know, that may be fair to say, but at the end of the day, like I said, we don't have a social media policy. We don't have anything that is in our union contract that, you know, agrees with these guidelines that were put out by management. There is nothing in the guidelines about punishment, any warning, any protocol or anything like that. You know, I wasn't given a warning. I wasn't sat down and had a conversation. They kept calling it an educational moment, but took no time to teach me. In fact, the first, you know, their decision was to take me off of it flat out. So, you know, I just thought that was interesting. And I just felt like it was because I was speaking out about this issue as a Black woman. I really felt like that played a big part in how it can be perceived as bias.
Do you know of any other instances where a reporter put out some tweets, a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter put out some tweets that was then followed up with this kind of action? I mean, there's been a lot of news in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. challenging news over the past, you know, many years that have had impacts on different parts of the community there.
Not since I've been here, you know, in 2018 that I actually know of. And in fact, there was a white male reporter who tweeted something about the protest over the weekend. He's now came out and, you know, identified himself. I don't want to keep, you know, putting his name out there, but he has, you know, kind of advocated on my behalf, kind of testified on my behalf that he also was called that same day about something that he put out on Twitter. And he was told, you know, that it wasn't appropriate, but he was not taken off covering the protest. I was the only person that was. And in fact, he wrote something that was protest related the very next day. And it wasn't until our union president pointed out, you know, why was Alexis taken off of this issue and not this other reporter, when you talked to them both on the same day about their tweets in separate conversation. And it was only retroactively that they decided to pull him once we brought that to their attention. So, you know, that was kind of my main argument with them. You know, the conversation that I had with them was not quick. You know, I pushed back on it. I said, you know, can you please explain to me how this violates these guidelines? You know, I asked, you know, what is the standard? You know, where is the line? Because like you said, there has been issues in the past. Tree of Life massacre, for example, happened in 2018. And I said to them specifically, I don't think anybody would have gotten in trouble for tweeting that, you know, white supremacy was bad after an incident like that. So I did ask them for clarification, you know, where was the standard? And I kind of really just got, you know, the runaround about these social media guidelines that were not very clear.
And I just wanted you to briefly describe what has happened to the other stories that you have reported recently, or even the stories of people who your colleagues who have stood beside you during this. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing here that some of their stories have been just removed from the Post-Gazette's website.
I know, saying it like that really does, you know, put into perspective about how kind of, you know, unprecedented it really is. But yeah, so on Friday, our union made the decision to have all of my union members stand beside me on this issue. They all tweeted out the same exact Kenny Chesney tweet from their Twitter accounts and with the hashtag I Stand With Alexis, which, you know, it kind of caught on to people outside of the union. I mean, there were people just tweeting it, you know, just because they supported me. And I Stand With Alexis ended up trending in Pennsylvania by the end of that night. But two of those reporters that tweeted support for me had already covered protest coverage that day. And by the end of that night, their stories were taken down off of our website and put up the next day under new links without bylines. And they were very, very much edited versions of the original. So the Post-Gazette has kind of, you know, we are definitely calling it, it's a retaliation against those who showed support for me.
Mm. Now, as you know, Alexis, just this morning, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette put out an open letter. It's just headlined an open letter from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Mm-hmm. It is quite long, so obviously I'm not going to be able to read the whole thing. We'll put a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. But I just want to read a little bit of it to you and get your response, okay? Because sure. It starts by saying, editors at this paper did not single out a black reporter and a black photographer and ban them from covering Pittsburgh protests after the killing of George Floyd. That is an outrageous lie, a defamation, in fact. And then it goes on to say, no one was taken off the protest story because of race. One person was not assigned a story because of the suggestion of bias. A tweet was issued and a dialogue followed that editors felt was strong commentary, opinion, on a story the reporter was only supposed to report. This person was not taking off the story, but was never on it. And this person doesn't cover race or protests. There is no such beat. This person covers social media normally. Your response?
I mean, this is, you know, I kind of woke up to this just like the rest of the world. I have a lot to say about it, but I'm kind of waiting for guidelines from our lawyer to really address that link from earlier. But I guess what I can say is, you know, my job description has gone beyond social media, and that can be proven by just checking my bylines on postgazette.com.
Okay. Well, I just want to read a little bit more here because this is kind of one of the central questions that we're going to be grappling with. The Post-Gazette says they did what they did for purely journalistic reasons. And then they go on to say, what our editors did was remind colleagues of a longstanding canon of journalism ethics. When you announce an opinion about a person or a story you're reporting on, you compromise your reporting, and your editor may take you off the story. This is a long-held tradition at this newspaper and at every good newspaper. You can disagree with that ethic or dismiss it as passé, but you cannot fairly call it racism. So I wonder if you want to respond to that and also just sort of tell us more broadly, like, where are you seeing the purpose of great journalism now, Alexis? Well, go ahead.
Like I said, there's only so much I can say really about that. But, you know, I just do want to point out that our executive editor, Keith Burris, is also head of our editorial board. So that's that. And, you know, as far as just the larger scope of journalism, I think, you know, these kind of almost archaic rules of objectivity kind of, you know, there needs to be more conversation around them. We need to talk about who made those rules and why. And, you know, the time period in which they came about. I mean, this was clearly before social media, clearly before everybody was given a platform to speak out and to speak their minds freely, because, you know, this is my personal Twitter account. It's not a Post-Gazette Twitter account that they assigned to me or manage in any form or fashion. So I'm happy to be a part of this larger conversation, I think, which is what we're about to have about what objectivity really looks like, where that line is now, and is there room to kind of move the goalposts,
right?
And who gets reprimanded and who doesn't?
Well, Alexis Johnson, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thank you so much, Alexis.
Thank you.
We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with the media's own internal reckoning with race. And I'm joined now from Philadelphia by Erin Haynes. She's editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization that reports on gender, politics, and policy. And prior to that, Erin was the national race and ethnicity reporter for The Associated Press. Erin, it's good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Meghna. It's good to be with you again.
And also with us from Washington is Akilah Johnson. She is a healthcare reporter for ProPublica, previously covered the intersection of race, politics, youth, and immigration for the Boston Globe. And during her time there at the Globe, she also won the Pulitzer Prize, or was on the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013. Akilah, it's great to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So let me ask, Aaron, let me just start with you, because I want to actually go back in time a little bit and then do some comparing and contrasting about where we are in terms of the media and race, because you were on the ground in Ferguson several years ago, and it was a place and a story and an event in American history where many black journalists were the ones that helped open the nation's eyes to what was happening. First of all, did you see or experience anything like what Alexis was describing to us that happened to her? Did you see or experience anything like that back when you were covering Ferguson?
Well, let me just first say that I was there with my sister Akilah, mm-hmm. whose voice it is so good to hear this morning. We were on the ground together in Ferguson and frankly had to stick together when things got
yes.
hairy. But, I would say that, things... that was not something that I personally experienced, but I did see that there were other black journalists whose objectivity was questioned, as if we suddenly became unprofessional the day that the Black Lives Matter movement began. And if anything, I realized that it was black journalists who were uniquely qualified to tell the truth of America in that moment. I mean, the premise that police were anything but noble and to be trusted completely was held by many white Americans, including white Americans in newsrooms, because their experience had never been anything to the contrary. Meanwhile, that experience was routine for many black Americans, meaning that black journalists or someone in their family or their friend circle were directly impacted by this issue.
Akilah, jump in here.
Yeah. And, I'm going to amplify quite a bit of what Aaron said. Mm. And also, I just really want to point out that because of that life experience, because so many black journalists do the work of reading, speaking, engaging with experts, trying to really understand and contextualize the history, it extends beyond just our moving through the world in a black body, and that is crucial. But we also do the work to find out the history and what that means. And it's important because it helps contextualize and paint a much more nuanced picture of what is happening in these situations to further really kind of dig into what fairness and what accuracy and what truth looks like in those instances.
Mm. Well, and by the way, basically any question I'm going to ask right now applies to both of you. So feel free to just jump in left and right. No problem.
So it'll be like our phone conversations, basically. Exactly.
Exactly.
Well, because I really want to understand from both of you sort of where we are now and how much it's changed, mm-hmm. In ways it's changed for the better and ways that it's changed for the worse. Because, as I said at the top of the show, like journalists like to consider themselves among those hands that hold up the mirror to America. So are we taking an honest look back as what's being reflected back about our own institutions? OK, so has in terms of attitudes or experiences that you've had in your own newsroom, how much has that changed since the work that you did covering Ferguson?
Well, I think that because the country has changed, black journalists and our response to this moment is also changing. Look, there's a national reckoning happening around race that centers on confronting institutional racism, and no institutions are immune, and that includes American newsrooms. And so while we've seen kind of these pained conversations happening in the wake of editorial decisions around race at places like the New York Times or the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette or the Philadelphia Inquirer, I would submit that just because your newsroom is not in the headlines today, that does not mean that your newsroom does not have an issue. It is a fantasy to think that issues of race are not relevant in American newsrooms right now. And frankly, for black journalists in particular, we're just simply not interested in writing stories about inequality and racism, only to have to battle those kinds of issues internally in a newsroom. I mean, I think that what's similar to 2014, a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the coverage and the reporting is the outrage. How many young black people are ready to put their bodies on the line for things to change, and just kind of the unveiling anew of the underlying systemic problems in communities that are exacerbating tensions between Black folks and the police that are sworn to serve them and protect them. But what is new, a few things, the attitudes are changing for many more white Americans, which I think is encouraging because it is going to take a plurality of Americans to believe that something is wrong for things to change, right? I mean, that's the way that progress and the perfection of our democracy has always worked. I think that's what I would say about kind of where we are and how that is impacting how Black journalists are thinking about systemic racism and the need to confront that across all institutions.
I would jump in and say too that, like, if you think about how the industry has changed, I'm going to take us back a little bit further beyond Ferguson. So Aaron and I got our start in journalism through MetPro. Shout out to MetPro, a diversity program that was intent on bringing journalists of color and making sure journalists of color had a place in newsroom, but not just a place, right? Not just to kind of be a body in the room, but that we had the skills to succeed and that we knew how to navigate newsroom politics as Black and brown journalists in newsrooms, and that we had mentorships that extended and relationships that extended beyond kind of the network of people in your newsroom kind of throughout the country, right? You walked in armed with strategic understanding of how to navigate newsroom politics. And with newsroom politics comes politics of race and how to push for stories, advocate for stories, deal with kind of HR conflicts and things of that nature. And so why is that important? Because as we begin to see the industry shrinking, I can't help but wonder kind of what the deficit that is lost. You know, there's a direct connection between me getting out of MetPro, me going into a newsroom that had a race and demographics team that kind of was some place for me to aspire to, colleagues for me to learn from, kind of also a signal of what newsroom priorities were, and absolutely, then watch that be dismantled in the recession. And then you watch how that carries you through a new newsroom, right? Because I went from Florida to Boston, and it helped me understand how to raise my hand and say, I need to be in Ferguson covering this. And I need to be in Ferguson covering this, helping people in Boston, not even helping because the relevance was there. You know, in covering different things in the city of Boston and having covered issues in the Black community, in education, in looking at how race intersects with education and race had intersected with criminal justice, there was, I understood the relevance of what was happening in Ferguson within a context that was happening in Black communities and frustrations in Boston and kind of throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And so as we're entering this moment where we begin to talk about it and look at newsroom diversity and how that influences coverage, those programs and these really strategic ways of positioning Black journalists and journalists of color to succeed in newsrooms have been dismantled because of, you know, financial reasons and a myriad of other explanations and excuses. And I think as we begin to understand and look at a reckoning in journalism, it's time to kind of reevaluate and begin to have conversations about the importance of pipeline building,
right?
You know, beyond just having bodies in the room.
Right.
And diversity as a journalistic imperative. I mean, it is not just, you know, a good decision morally in terms of it being the right thing to do. It is an economic imperative. You have a blind spot if you do not have a diverse newsroom that is ready to confront the issues of our time. How many times routinely in the past few years have the top headlines, the biggest stories in our country been about race? You know, if you do not have a newsroom that is ready to address those stories and to contextualize them and to make them about facts and not, you know, feelings, as visual coverage is often treated, then you are at a deficit as a newsroom.
Yeah. I mean, and one of those basic facts is that the nation with every generation becomes more diverse. So if newsrooms are committed to actually reflecting the nation they cover, they ought to become more diverse too, by fact, I would say. But there's something in particular about some presumptions that I've read and we've heard being made about Black journalists right now, and I want to ask about, you know, has this happened to you, that the presumption of, because you are Black, that you carry with you some sort of lack of objectivity? And we can talk about that word also in a second, but some lack of objectivity in covering stories right now about police violence, about the protests, because I do think we have to confront that a little bit. Is that happening?
I mean, we can't say that it's not happening. You just had Alexis on that, right, was talking about, you know, and dissecting that whole issue. I can say personally, for me, I have not had that experience kind of blatantly thrown in my face. Now, not in this moment, and maybe not previously. I've had some, you know, there have been other kind of coded conversations, and I've had, and I go back to the importance of mentors and advocates in newsroom, and people who I know have probably covered me from things that I didn't even realize were happening, and conversations that were happening kind of throughout the newsroom or at upper levels, and I am eternally grateful for that. But no, like I feel very fortunate that I am in a position where my bosses, that has not been a question and it has not been raised. And as a matter of fact, it's quite been the opposite, which I don't, you know, in terms of, you come with this wealth of knowledge, mm-hmm, you come with this point of view, you come with kind of a body of work. It is even more relevant in this time. And those are the stories that we want to tell.
Erin, go ahead. Did you want to respond to that too?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I would say is that, part of this reckoning in American newsrooms is around the question of objectivity, right? Because I think that for what a lot of us are realizing, you know, as newsrooms have become more in the past few generations, is that male and pale has been the default setting. And when that is the default setting, it's easy to be objective, right? I have been very fortunate in my career. I was raised in the National Association of Black Journalists. I got my start in Atlanta at the Atlanta Daily World, which was a Black newspaper. And so what that told me, what I learned as I was emerging into this industry, is that our stories mattered, that they were important, and that I didn't need to justify why they were newsworthy. And so that has kind of fortified me with an understanding that my lived experience is an asset for me as a reporter, not a liability. And I've been very fortunate in my career to work in places where that has, for the most part, been valued. And when it has not, or when my objectivity or approach to a story has been questioned, I mean, like Akilah said, I have both a body of work to stand on and an expertise, mm-hmm, that allows me to push back against that.
Right. You know, and I'm just thinking to myself, and I can't think of a moment. And so listeners out there, if you can, please go ahead and send us a tweet at On Point Radio. But, you know, for example, the question of whether or not a reporter can be objective in the past has never been raised about things like religion, right? To your point, Erin, like, it was seen as an asset if someone, mm-hmm, you know, grew up in a particular religious tradition, understood, yeah, the nuances, et cetera, and could communicate and dig up stories within that religion in a way that, like, maybe other reporters couldn't. So I've never heard of someone being criticized for that, but I do hear it occasionally with reporters of color, right?
You're right, Meghna. I mean, I thought about this even just kind of thinking back in the past few years. I mean, were white reporters who were covering the Occupy protests or Tea Party movement, were they seen as biased, you know, when they were sent out to cover these? Were women reporters seen as biased when they went to cover the Women's March, you know, back in 2017? I don't remember these same questions being raised. And let me just say, you know, because I was one of the people here in Pennsylvania that did tweet on Alexis's behalf, and I love what she said about being a millennial who speaks Twitter. I'm not a millennial.
Yes.
Twitter, but you know, Alexis, what Alexis was doing was pointing out hypocrisy. And is that not what we do in journalism? What did she say that was not true? right? I mean, the reaction to what she said is more telling than the tweet itself for me. And I think the question is, as you talked about with her, Magna, would Alexis have gotten in trouble for this tweet if she were not Black? And could a white reporter have tweeted this and had their objectivity questioned? Would they have faced the same punishment, right? And I think that she, you know, she talked about her colleague who was later punished. But I mean, our country is literally having a conversation about equality, and these two reporters were not initially tweeted equally.
Well, let me ask you about that, because is it that perhaps the problem is that her managers don't, quote unquote, speak Twitter too? Would, we don't know, but would it have been different if Alexis's tweet, instead of being, you know, a little tongue in cheek, had been, you know, we're talking about looting with the current protests. Have we had the same amount of scrutiny for the damage that was done following a Kenny Chesney concert? Just the tone and the language. Same point, but different approach. Would that have made it, would that have obviated the problem?
Magna, I think the issue is that in a city that is 23% Black, at least as of 2018, that newspaper was 2% Black.
Akilah, do you want to jump in on this?
I feel like there's a period at the end of that sentence, particularly what Aaron just said regarding the demographics of the newspaper versus the demographics of the city. You know, I mean, that is like, I just kind of want to go back and underline, italicize, and then put that in bold, because I think that is, you know, that is imperative. And it speaks to a few things, right? It speaks to a news organization's conversation with the community that it is covering and or lack thereof. And it begins to raise some serious questions as to the type of conversation that news organizations have with the communities that they cover. And I'm intentionally using the word conversation, right? Because part of what news organizations do is we convene conversations for the communities that we cover, because people are talking about the issues that we raise and our coverage.
Right. Well, there's a lot more to talk about in this conversation, so let's just take a quick break and we'll come right back. We're talking about media organizations and their own internal reckonings with race. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to be talking with members of the high school class of 2020. And if you are a just recently or soon to be high school graduate, we want to hear your stories and your thoughts about what it's like to cross into full-blown adulthood in the middle of a pandemic, in the midst of this nationwide reckoning we're having with race and law enforcement. I mean, how are current events changing your plans about what you want next for your life? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're looking for the voices of high school grads in the class of 2020. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the media's own internal reckoning with race. And I'm joined from Washington by Akilah Johnson. She's healthcare reporter for ProPublica. And from Philadelphia, Erin Haynes is with us. She's editor-at-large for The 19th as well. And, you know, I mentioned, Akilah and Erin, I mentioned before the break, we would talk about this word objectivity a little bit. So let's just do that, okay? In the context of America and journalism in 2020, just give me, Erin, I'll just start with you here. Give me your thoughts on, like, what does journalistic objectivity mean? How should we be defining it?
you know, I mean, I think, as you mentioned, Meghna, I am here in Philadelphia, and I am thinking a lot about, in this moment, what it means to be somebody who is helping to perfect this democracy, right? And somebody who is helping to dismantle systemic racism through journalism, which I do believe should be the goal. A lot of people see what is happening in this country now as the latest iteration of our American Revolution. And I think that that has to include how we reimagine journalism in some ways. I'm certainly somebody that was raised on the core tenets of journalism and am very committed to that. I love this industry and I love this institution, and I'm very proud to work for the 19th, where we are trying to create the kind of newsroom that we frankly wish a lot of us had had. And, you know, in envisioning that newsroom, we center not objectivity, but some of the other tenets of journalism: fairness, truth. You know, at its core, the best journalism does what? I mean, it shines a light on inequality. It afflicts the comfortable. It rights wrongs. And reporting on race is among the best ways that we can do that. And so, you know, I think that while, like I said, I mean, objectivity is easy when you think about the people who kind of created those rules and who those people were. Those people did not look like me, and they did not envision me being a colleague when those standards were put in place.
Mm. Akilah?
But I mean, yeah. And so, you know, when I think about objectivity, like Aaron said, you know, I was raised, you know, in the tenets of journalism. That is like kind of the school that I came up with. But I never have personally struggled with the question of objectivity and what that looks like, because in that rearing in this school of kind of I will call them traditional journalism tenets, for lack of a better phrase right now, right? Objectivity means being able to set aside your own kind of personal beliefs to get at the heart of the matter, to get at the truth of something. And so I'm going to get at the truth of it. And this takes me back to questions. And I get this question all the time. And I think most journalists get this question. Are you going to write a good story? Is this going to be a good story? I don't do bad stories. Do a good story. And I say, well, it'll be a fair story. It'll be an accurate story. It will be a truthful story. Now, I can't guarantee you will like what I write. As in, I don't know what your definition of good is, because if you're doing some wrong stuff, I will treat you fairly, and I will, you know, portray what you were saying accurately, and it will be contextualized, and I can promise you, you won't feel misrepresented by what I write. Now, will you like it, and will you classify it as good? I'm not going to make you that promise. And so I think in this moment and around these discussions of objectivity, I approach it that very same way.
Yeah. I mean, I just paused there because I'm just thinking through this, and I completely agree. I mean, objectivity traditionally has been seen, just as you're saying, Akilah, as this standard of not having anyone, an individual reporter's reporting being influenced by their personal feeling or opinion. And what I believe is that that no one should ever do that, but that doesn't mean that one's personal experience doesn't come into to deepening the understanding of the story that they're reporting. Does that make sense? Right?
Because absolutely.
That's what we're talking about. Because I think like what happens with this word objectivity is people conflate feeling. People who are debating this word conflate feeling versus experience. Right? I mean, like experience actually should be held up as that deep well from which
exactly.
You know, we draw a skill set that leads to great journalism.
You know, and experiences are the things that when you've got local news reporters going through police reports that maybe are going to have someone that are going to catch one reporter's eye and maybe not catch another reporter's eye, just in terms of charges or what, you know, if you're seeing a lot of police reports, say for jaywalking or street gambling, well, some people may dismiss that. Other people may begin to say, well, what does that mean? Street gambling could be like playing dice and craps on the street, and that could lead to a whole different type of story and conversation and understanding of what's happening in particular community and or relationship between, you know, community and police. And it comes from experience and just kind of maybe understanding how some of these different things play out in different parts of your community. And so, I mean, that's what you bring to it. But then that doesn't mean that I'm going to engage with various sources, like it's going to change who I'm going to for information, why I'm going to them, the types of questions that I'm asking, you know, the types of interrogation that an interrogation being like interrogation of the story to get to the truth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, that's what we do as journalists. We have to interrogate stories and facts to get to the truth. And you may not like it, but that, you know, my job is not to have you like me.
Correct. We're not in the popularity business, Meghna. And I would just add to what Akilah said. I mean, I think that we really have to ask ourselves some tough questions, but what they shouldn't be tough questions, but they feel like tough questions in newsrooms. Do you believe that there are both sides to racism, to misogyny, to misinformation? Because objectivity is what gets you to phrases like racially charged. You understand what I mean? Like we are here to tell the truth. And if we are not going to tell, you know, objectivity, I feel like too often is cover for people cover for people's discomfort about some of the truths that we have to tell about this country.
So, but this is a challenging road. I'm just going to say this is a challenging road to navigate. And for example, with what's happening with Alexis in Pittsburgh, we're seeing that right now. I mean, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, you heard me read part of the statement that they put out today. You know, they soundly reject the notion that their actions regarding Alexis were racism. They even call that a defamation, Aaron.
Yeah. Again, that newspaper overall is 12% minority as of 2018. There are at least one in five people in Pittsburgh are Black. I think that they need to do maybe a little bit more listening. I think that for white Americans in general, being defensive in this moment is not necessarily the right response. I mean, there is a dialogue happening that I think that we all need to be a part of, and that includes those of us in journalism.
And yeah, and those of us in journalism, you know, going back to mentors and advocates who help you to figure out ways to strategically navigate newsrooms, right? Aaron and I learned this phrase, Aaron, and you will recognize this, put journalism first. So in all of these difficult conversations, I come back to that, put journalism first. And so what does that mean? That means, and Aaron said this earlier too, so many times when we have conversations about race, we focus on feelings. Well, let's take feelings out of it. Let's take the personal out of it. Let's focus on journalism. We're an evidence-based, you know, institution. Let's look at the evidence. So if I'm going to engage in conversations like this, which I often do, I mean, we're doing it now, right? Which is why let's go back to if 28% of your community is Black and 2% of your newsroom is Black, let's have a conversation about that and what that means. That is a telling statistic. That is evidence. You know, so let's remove feelings from this conversation. And I don't think we need to remove them from the conversation completely. But I think when you talk about race, it is so important to marry evidence and to bring in evidence to these conversations. And when we're doing this in a journalistic context, I always come back to put journalism first. What is the mission of your organization? What is the mission that you were trying to fulfill with the community, and how were you doing that, and or how were you failing to do that?
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about an example of those very tenets in practice. And so, Aaron, can we just talk about your the story that you recently published a couple of days ago, your interview with Breonna Taylor's mother about her daughter and the protests. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, last Friday should have been Breonna Taylor's 27th birthday, but we know that it was not, because we know that she was a Louisville EMT who was gunned down in her apartment by Louisville police. And, you know, I had written a story about a month earlier about her case, which had not gotten a lot of national attention, in part because obviously the pandemic was dominating our news coverage and our headlines. But she was an essential worker. And, you know, and I certainly wondered how much gender played a role in how much or how little attention her case was getting. I will also point out, I mean, there was not video in her case, which can certainly help to kind of fuel and galvanize folks around these incidents when they occur. And her case didn't have that. The police did. There was no body cam footage of this incident. But it was important to me to center her story on her birthday and to hear from her mother. Because, you know, we talk, you know, this conversation, there is a national conversation that is happening. You know, these protests have focused on not just the peaceful protesters, but also looting, also destruction of property, like really just centering the issue that has brought us all to this moment, which is the unrelenting killing of Black people by law enforcement or vigilantes. It was important for me to do that. And as a Black woman, I wanted to make sure that Breonna Taylor's story was among those that are continuing to be told in this moment. And I felt like hearing from her mother, who I had built a relationship with, was one of the more powerful ways that I could use journalism to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, it's a very well done story, Erin. And just to plug it a little bit more, we're going to put links to it at onpointradio.org.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate you mentioning that.
Look, we've got about three-ish minutes left. I want to know if you think that that actually what we're seeing right now in terms of this overdue reckoning is also the signs. Are we also seeing the signs of progress, right? Because, I mean, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette aside, we've had, you know, an apology from the Philadelphia Inquirer. We've had a couple of editors in other places step down. I'm not sure that's something that we would have seen before. So is there evidence that there's not just a reckoning, but a recognition that things need to change, Akilah?
Yes, I would think so. I also happen to be an eternal optimist. So, you know, I will give you that caveat. But I mean, I can speak personally, too. Like, you know, in our newsroom, I work for ProPublica, and we are committed to diversity. And I think in this moment, there has been a recognition and a statement that it's even more relevant and important of an issue now than it has been before, you know? And so the conversations that predated this moment are continuing, and they're continuing at greater depth and nuance in terms of how can we recruit, retain, promote, diversify within our ranks. And, you know, these are not always comfortable conversations or conversations that are neatly tied up in a bow, but they are necessary conversations. And it's not just conversation, but it's conversation that leads to action and change. And I do believe that we are seeing that. Could we see more? Absolutely. But we are seeing it.
Mm. Erin, what do you think?
You know, Meghna, I don't know. Because to cover race, which was the focus of my career, is to be very clear about what America is and is not capable of. And so while I am hopeful, I have to acknowledge that we are only at the beginning of this conversation. And, you know, I think it remains to be seen what our attention span and appetite is for change. I think it's interesting. I've heard a lot of people and journalists I've been in conversation with who refer to this as kind of similar to the Me Too movement, but with racism, right? People are being confronted. People are being held accountable in this moment, but we can't look at what is happening as isolated incidents that need to be addressed.
Right.
This is on a continuum. This is systemic, and we must confront the system.
You know, I have to say the combination of optimism and realism to me is a pretty good place to start when we're aiming for great journalism, to be perfectly honest, if I could. So Erin Haynes, editor-at-large for The 19th, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Anytime, Meghna. Thanks so much.
And Akilah Johnson, healthcare reporter with ProPublica. Akilah, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.